Thanks so much for tuning into this podcast, produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. For more information on KUT programs and to support the station, go to KUT.org. And thanks again.
We're going to discuss tonight the psychological functions our homes can serve, the processes by which people shape the spaces around them, and what we can learn about personalities from things. Here with me to discuss all of these things and much more, UT professor of psychology and author of Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You, welcome Sam Gosling.
Thank you.
And managing partner and lead residential designer for, is it Sentiment? Architecture, Christopher Travis, welcome. Thank you so much for coming. So we will have questions toward the end, and Nadav is going to come around with a mic. Be sure to just raise your hand. He'll come right to you, and make sure you're on mic because we are recording this evening. So Christopher, let's start with you, kind of, and get a big picture. There's a quote on your website that says, when people choose to change their living space, what they really want is a new and better life. There is a simple reason traditional methods of buying, designing, and building homes often fail to provide a better life. Home isn't a building. It's an experience, really a whole suite of experiences. That means your perfect home is in your head and heart, not in the bricks and sticks of your project. It's a psychological fingerprint embedded in your brain, one that is unique for each of us. That's such a beautiful statement, and I know it's been quite a process of you coming to this space where you're interacting with people on this level and inquiring about really their lives and their emotional state. Can you talk a little bit about your journey as a designer and what brought you to this space?
Well, I think it started with a bankruptcy. And that's actually is actually true. So what had happened is that I got out of design and construction in the late 80s in Houston. And for about 4 years, I did something else, and that business went south. And so I had a daughter who's over there getting ready to go to UT, and I had no money. And I also was quite burnt out with living in Houston, especially given that I'd gone through a bankruptcy. So I what I did was, my wife and I, after a year of being upset, we decided that what we were going to do is create our life anew, essentially, which is what, of course, all bankrupt people get to do. And so I actually found this little bitty tiny town where I live now, a town called Round Top that has 90 people in it, and I was lucky enough to get a large restoration project there. But my life was pretty much a mess. I was still dealing with lawyers. I was living week to week, separated from my wife and kids during the week, and the oddest thing happened. I was in one of these old buildings, and I'd sit out, and by the way, I was sleeping on an air mattress, and there were mice that ran over me at night. Isn't that dramatic? I didn't have any incurable diseases, but, you know. But what happened was I'd take my guitar on this porch in a small town, covered sawdust in the evenings, and start playing on the porches. And that's after all what you do when you get off of work, you don't know anybody. And I just found myself incredibly happy. And I thought that was really counterintuitive because, after all, my life was completely trashed. So I started thinking about that, and what I suddenly remembered was another building that reminded me of that old German farmhouse that I was sitting on the porch. It was a pier and beam house. It was had an old plank porch, and it was kind of raised up. And I remember my great-grandfather's house when I was a little kid. And that was another really tough time in my life. My mother was raising two children alone and trying to go to school. So we spent a lot of time at my great-grandparents. So what I realized was that I had somehow psychologically associated the architecture of that building with this place in my childhood where had been the safest and the most loved. And it was very profound realization. This is back in 1992, so quite a long time ago. And I just started asking questions about that. You know, how, what else? It did, what other ways would I automatically respond without even thinking about it to environments I was in? And then what did my clients, how was that for them? And so that's kind of what led to the early stages of it.
Never let a crisis go to waste, as they say.
Yeah.
So you fast forward, this is 1992, so fast forward a little bit, and you are talking with your clients about this process of kind of looking inward to create this space to kind of accentuate and nurture their relationships, their beings. What is that conversation like with your clients? How do you approach that?
Well, I have a large kind of questionnaire and workshop that I send them home, make them do a lot of homework, and it combines sort of architectural programming questions like a normal designer would use, and then it also includes a lot of questions about their relationships, about their childhood homes, about their privacy and intimacy needs, about their personal values. And so they go home with this big woo-woo questionnaire, and then they come back to me, and each the couples have to do their homework independently. This helps me reduce the number of divorces I have in my practice. And then we have two very long sessions where they read each answer, and so there's a great number of the questions that are sort of psychologically oriented. And what I'm trying to get at, essentially, is sort of who are they relative to home? Because what I found in the process of doing what I do is that most of, if not, I mean by most, like, as far as I can tell, almost all of people's automatic reactions to a living space are what actually defines what choices they'll make. And that people aren't always particularly aware of things that are going to be the most suitable for them. And so so the problem really was that in architecture and design, it's kind of like designing websites, and that is that when people come into your office, you're lucky if 60 to 70% of what they tell you is what they really want. And there's a large percentage of people who, and I had done this before, designed houses that people told me was what they wanted. And very often they say, I don't like that, it's my fault. So I quit doing that because it was bad for my business. And I started figuring out, kind of get into their heads and become clear about who they were around home.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me. You know, a lot of the places that we go into these homes, we react kind of like with our gut to something. But a lot of times because we can't verbalize why we like something the way it is, because it's kind of below our level of conscious awareness, we have a difficult time trusting that. How do you both actually maybe interact with people who just, they don't really know how to articulate why they like something? They haven't really gotten there yet, but do you kind of teach them to trust that instinct?
Well, I start by not believing anything they say. That's what I do. What do you do, Sam? I don't act like that in front of them after all they're paying me, what I do is I use a lot of images, and this is kind of stuff that Sam does in his work also, and I try to introduce them to the idea, and actually it's pretty simple and intuitive when you think about it. Most people do realize that it really wasn't a building they want, it's the life the building would give them, and they know that life is about how you feel. And in fact, the part more permanent aspects of a home are actually emotional, in my experience. So they come with a lot of technical and sort of style and intellectual sort of point of view about what they want. But there's actually a place in almost every feature of your home, which it just essentially feels right, and that doesn't go away. So I look for all of those.
This is a very common experience where we can do things very well, but have no idea how we do them. Like, I can immediately recognize a grammatical sentence, but I couldn't tell you the grammar. And I could immediately tell you the difference between a male face and a female face, but I couldn't articulate the rules by which I'm making that decision. So there's lots of these processes that are automatic, and there are lots of them we try to come up with explanations for. But I think you know, that even if there is some systematicity to it, I think often when we, our experience is something as kind of as superficial as, you know, I just like it. And I certainly, well, for my book, I interviewed a few of Chris's, a few of his clients. And what we found there was exactly what Chris had told me. Chris had told me that people are, well, even after going through his long process and the interviews and everything like that, even after that, they were very resistant to seeing the connection between the process he had been, that they had been through, and the spaces of their house. I Chris would point to something in the house where he had designed specifically as a result of what they had said. So I'd be interested to talk to the client and say, so tell me about that. You know, can you tell me a little bit about why you have that shelf there and what it means to you, knowing why Chris had done it? And they'd say, well, you know, I kind of just like it. And even if I'd pushed, they'd kind of come up with explanations, but they'd be very, I don't know if it's just resistant or clueless, but it's one of those about why they liked it.
Yeah. It's really difficult to verbalize those kind of connections that we have. Sam, let's come to your work. There's a very interesting line that you said. I wasn't sure if it was in an interview or in the book, but you say people's things sometimes say something about them and betray something about them as well. Let's talk a little bit about your research with Snoop, your book, and some of your current research. What is that association that we have with things that is perhaps very similar with our association with homes? Like, we want it to be something, we think it symbolizes something, but it's really not us.
Well, I mean, I think there are some ways we express ourselves quite deliberately, and some ways we do inadvertently. In my initial research, I spent a lot of time looking at student dorm rooms, and those are really terrific spaces to study, because on the first day of semester, if you went to all of those rooms, you wouldn't know which room you're in, because they all look absolutely identical. Absolutely, you know, you wouldn't know which one. Yet, within 2-3 months of being in those spaces, they are radically different. And the only reason they are different 100% as a result of the things done by the person who's living there. And so what I'm really interested in is how that change comes about. And it comes about through a number of mechanisms. So I think some of those things are deliberate. We do things to our space, especially, you know, perhaps in students who are struggling with the task of saying, who am I? You know, I've left home, and it's, you know, identity tasks, essentially. A lot of the things in those spaces are what I call identity claims, which are these deliberate expressions we make about ourselves. You know, and we all do this all the time. You know, anyone who has something on their T-shirt or, you know, or bumper sticker. I mean, we're constantly trying to be known by others, and we want others to understand who we are. And those statements we're making, I think, are typically not disingenuous. They are honest signals about this is what's important to me. Because there's a lot of research in psychology showing that people are happier, healthier, and more productive when they can get others to see them as they see themselves. So I think people genuinely want to be known, even if they could, in theory, create a false impression. So I think some of the things we do to our space are about projecting that identity, you know, the bands you like or whatever it is. We also affect our space deliberately, where the purpose isn't specifically to try and send a message, but it's to make us feel a certain way. And Chris includes a lot of these things in his design. But this is what I call like thought and feeling regulators, where we put things in our space because they make us feel a certain way or they make us think about certain things. So, like, you know, many people probably here have a photo of a loved one on their phone or something like that. Why? Why do you have that? Because you can kind of look down. It's what some psychologists have called social snacks. It's like you're away and from your loved one, you can look down on the photo, and it's like a little snack you have, and then you get back to what you're doing. And lots of things in our space are like that. We create, you know, the easy way, of course, that we affect our spaces is with music we play. You know, if we want to get kind of pumped up for a, you know, wild night on the town, we listen to one sort of music, but if you want to have a relaxing time, you listen to another. So we are changing our space all the time to affect how we feel. Although I don't think people are aware of it, as Chris has said. I think people just thought, oh, I'd like to listen to that now or that. Mm-hmm. So those are sort of the deliberate things we do. But also, we betray ourselves unconsciously just by nature of doing things. So we do lots of things, and a subset of those things leave a material trace in the environment, what I call behavioral residue. And so you can look at people's spaces. Like, for example, you know, my desk is messy. It's very messy. And it's messy not because I want to send a signal that it's messy. It doesn't make me feel better. It's just because I get something out and kind of get distracted and put it down, layers of sediment slowly like form on the desk. And then suddenly it's a messy desk. And so I think that is another way people sort of betray their activities. And it's a way that's quite hard to fake as well. So if you are an expert at kind of reading these clues, you can go in and learn quite a lot about a person from snooping around.
And we want to learn what we can learn about people as well. But I'm curious, how many people have read Sam's book? Show of hands, maybe clap. That's easier for us. Okay, so quite a few people. Or perhaps heard
not
him
enough.
On Talk of the Nation.
Not nearly enough.
Quite a few. Yeah, I'm an optimist, right? But, you know, I'm really curious. It's such an interesting topic, and to go around and look at people's things and to see how they're positioned and what that says about them. How did you come about studying this? You know, what is your background? Have you been a snoop since you were very small, or did you just think, you know what, I really am interested in this, and I want to find out what it says about people?
Well, I initially came to it because I'm interested in personality, but most psychologists and personality psychologists in academia are very, very unimaginative and boring. And so what they do, if they want to find out something, like they just ask you. But you know, there's all kinds of reasons why you might be mistaken about that. You might. So it occurred to me that one way of finding out about people's behavior would be to look at traces of their behavior. And so I initially thought maybe we can look in people's spaces to try and learn about people. And then once I got into spaces, I realized how rich they were psychologically and became very interested in this connection between people and their space.
And Christopher, you have been collaborating with Sam for a few years now. Talk a little bit about that collaboration. When did you two meet and get to know that your work was so closely united?
What was that restaurant? We met downtown at that table. It was at the you don't remember.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
That was one of the best moments of my life.
Was I there?
You were there. Well, actually, I was looking for a psychometrician, and I had just started my very advanced and still not launched software project to do what I do online, which is what I was up to, and I wanted to find a type of a psychologist who's a numbers guy, essentially. And so I was surfing the UT website, and I came upon this guy's Sam's very modest. The truth is he's done an enormous number of very creative types of research. He's done animal personality, he's Facebook personality, he's very good at coming up with very interesting research. And I went, wow, that guy's looking at the same kind of stuff I am. And so that was really it. I called him and told him what I was doing. He went, well, that's very interesting. So, and that's really what happened. He came to my house in Round Top and interviewed some of my clients, and I locked him in the bathroom, and he had to crawl out of the window in the middle of the night. Remember that? You remember that, don't you? Forget the hotel thing. So that was really it. And then he's always been extraordinarily supportive. And what I do is peculiar, and I'm not always supported, and Sam has always been an extraordinary support for me, in addition to having learned a lot from him.
I think what Chris does is very important, and it's unlike what anybody else is doing in architecture. And so when he told me about truly trying to understand the sort of the psychological meaning behind space and trying to implement that in a very practical way. There's lots of people who can like kind of talk about it and wave their hands around, but trying to implement that practically, I thought it was very interesting. But you know, as Chris says, I'm a numbers guy, so really our collaboration has been me trying to take the things he does, which I think are probably true, but he does from an intuitive background and just and his experience, trying to take those things and implement those systematically so we can measure them. A good example is, one of the things Chris does is he asks people, what sense would you like to evoke if you had, unlimited resources and there was nothing was holding you back? What sense would you like to evoke in the bedroom, in the living room, in the study, and so on? And he uses that. That's very central. If you look at his plans, though, the things people say are written on the plans. It's front and center. So he keeps that absolutely at the front. And I think that's very important, that it's always working towards that. But we didn't know does everybody want the same thing? Do different people want different things? Are there sort of basic dimensions underlying these preferences? My grad student, Lindsay Graham, and I, we started to try to take his procedures and scale them up and systematize them to see what there is to this.
And from that research, a lot of people can't really afford to go and have their homes designed for them. But what would you recommend for people going into an apartment complex or in a house? They're looking for a house. What would you tell them to kind of ask themselves and be aware of about the space and their relationship to it?
Well, how I see it is that, you're creating your space all the time, really. So be just first wake up to that. Most people, it's like we talk about what home really is, I think, is this sense of well-being and safety. It's a very ancient, it's pre-human being experience, and it's about being protected, And so if you, what you need to, the first thing to get is just whatever you create in your space is not independent of you. There's really fuzzy boundaries between self and your immediate environment. In fact, your immediate environment created you. You're a reflection of your immediate environment. So that's the first thing, is just notice that, if your house is a complete mess, that it supports that part of yourself. If you're, and my house is a complete mess, by the way, but that's not true. I have a wife that cleans it. But that's really what it is. Think about it like this. How there's bacteria in this room, and they're just coming in and out of all of us. And so we have this very, we're sharing a sort of a community here that's at all levels, biological, psychological, all levels. And that's really what your home is to you. And you carry forward these things, including your dysfunctions, the things you have, negative opinions of yourself. So look at what you're going to do in your house as essentially creating a more effective or more of the life you want, and just get that that's possible. Because you have to start with it, it's actually possible to do it. And I'm quite clear that it is, and it doesn't matter. You're right, people don't hire architects to design their apartments or their dorm rooms. But the truth is, within each of us, you have that option. It's more like just realizing that each space you enter creates a certain emotional context for you. And you, in the space you own, you have the opportunity to actually create that aspect of your life. So that's the big picture of it.
Yeah, and as far as things too, what types of questions would you ask people who would come to you with maybe a problem about, I don't really feel happy, and you go into their home, say, you look at the things that they have, and you see that they're kind of reflecting an image that this person does not kind of sync up with. Would you have them ask themselves questions about the things that they have, why they have them, why do we kind of decorate our spaces the way we do?
I guess my research hasn't looked directly at that. I mean, what we find is that these are typically pretty good ways of learning some things about people. I mean, Chris, has some interesting exercises you do with asking people about objects, right, from their past and so on like that. I think people may underestimate the sort of emotional value and emotional importance of things, of items. And, you know, I know at least one of Chris's exercises is about finding out what those are so those can form and be in a central place in the new space.
Well, let's fast forward a little bit here and talk about a whole other space in which we live, which is these spaces of social media, you know, our online kind of homes that we create for ourselves. What is different about the way that we create those homes, and how do they affect us maybe differently when we inhabit them?
Well, we've done quite a lot of work on a number of different forms of social media. One of them is a Facebook. I don't know if anyone's heard of that. And so what Facebook is very interesting because if you... Well, let's ask people. So who here thinks if you look at a Facebook profile, are you learning... You have two options. Option A is you're learning what the person's really like. Option B is you're learning about what they'd like to be like. All right? So first of all, who's not going to vote? All right, two people aren't going to vote. Okay, who thinks it's option A? You're really learning about people. All right, who thinks it's option B? You're learning what people would like it to be like. Well, it turns out some people said they were going to vote, were going to vote and didn't. it turns out that it's option A. You get a pretty good impression of people from looking at their Facebook profile, and I think that is because it's much harder to pull off a fake impression, even if you wanted to do that. I mean, if you think about the steps that would be required to really pull off a convincing false impression. So let's say I wanted to give the impression that I was a kind of a very sort of highbrow intellectual and a sensation seeker. Well, what would I have to do to give off that impression on my Facebook profile? If I'm not really into highbrow stuff, you know, how am I going to be able to talk in a convincing way about it? You know, how am I going to be able to talk about this new, you know, avant-garde theater company that's just started up that, you know, is my, if I don't know that stuff? But then, all right, so let's say I do find out about it. I have a highbrow friend who tells me about all of these things. And I think, all right, I'm going to give the impression that I really like this stuff. Well, that means I'm going to have to, like, you know, go to this stuff. I'm going to have photos, and if I'm not into it, I don't want to do it. If you want to be a sensation seeker, then what you should do is you should be swimming with the sharks and parachuting and things. Well, if you're not really a sensation seeker, you don't want to go swim with the sharks. And so doing these things is it requires quite a lot. And then even if you did it, let's say you went ahead and, you know, like maybe, okay, I'll Photoshop myself into these things. That doesn't work because you have a very high overlap between your offline and online friends. And your friends who know you, who know that I'm scared of sharks, would say there's no way you would ever do that. So there'd be such a high accountability that it would be very hard to pull off this kind of, a false impression in that way. And also, of course, the other thing is that you don't have full control over your Facebook profile, right? Other people can tag you in unflattering photos. You can be people to leave stuff on your wall, and you can untag yourself and delete them. But it's kind of bad Facebook form to do that too much. And so I think, in the end, it ends up being really another forum for just social interaction. I mean, it's kind of like the telephone now. It's just another way people interact. And our other research has shown that. You know, there was all this talk about how, well, Facebook is really good because it allows the introverts to kind of socially engage, whereas they can't do it in face-to-face contexts. But that's not what our research shows. It shows that the people who are really engaging and having more conversations and doing more things are the extroverts, just like they are in other contexts too. It's just another domain in which they can express their personalities.
So you're saying it's easier for us to hide from other people when we're in face-to-face interactions and when they're even in our homes than online?
I wouldn't say in their homes are not a good place to hide either, because And the reason is that it collects a accumulation of evidence. So if you were interviewing me for a job and I wanted to seem very responsible and outgoing, I could probably pull it off if I really focused on it, because I just have to focus for like half an hour or an hour and really keep on top of things. But it would be very hard for me to really change my house for the same, or my Facebook profile. I wouldn't even know what, I mean, one of the reasons is, it's very hard to see the world in a different way. So personality isn't just how we behave, it also includes how we perceive the world. One way I'll illustrate this is, I'm gonna ask, who in this audience carries spare stamps? Put your hand up if you carry spare stamps in your wallet or any, just don't be proud, put your hand up, and everybody else look around, see who does that.
That's more people than bought your book.
Thank you, Chris. And who does not carry spare stamps, all right? Put your hands up, okay, look around, okay. So we have mostly non-stamp carriers here. Now, I don't really care who carries spare stamps, but what's always interesting to me is the reactions of the people with their hands down, right? So the people who don't carry spare stamps and they see the people carrying spare stamps, they go, what? Why would you carry spare stamps? I've never even thought of doing that. And then the people who do carry spare stamps and they see all these people don't, they think, well, what happens when you need to mail a letter? And the thing is that for both groups of people, what you do seems like the self-evident thing to do. How could you possibly do it other ways? And so it's very hard to fake those kinds of differences, of seeing the world differently. I had a friend, they just see things differently. So my office neighbor has an absolutely immaculate office. So I could go into her office and take, one of the sharpened pencils from her pencil holder where it is and like turn that one pencil upside down and she would notice right away. Whereas you could come into my office and turn half the books on their side and I wouldn't notice. I just wouldn't. I had a friend staying at my house once, and she, as a hilarious joke, she like moved things around in my kitchen while I was gone. And then, she kept on waiting for me to say something. And eventually she asked me and said, so, did you get it? And I said, get what? I never noticed it. And so those sorts of things are very hard to fake, which is why looking at people's spaces, it's really looking at any place, whether it's a Facebook profile, a home, or an office, where people spend repeated amounts of time. It's very hard to fake those differences.
So what is your reaction to the people who raised their hand and thought that most people on their Facebook accounts faked them?
Well, I think it's an obvious intuition, because you think, oh, I could fake it. Like, is there so much control I have over this, I could fake it. But I think, and that's a very common intuition. There's so many, I'm just going to put up these cool photos and say certain things and like certain things and all those things. But I think that these people are not sort of thinking through the practical steps of what would be really required to pull off a convincing fake profile. And also, I think people aren't thinking that we kind of do that in everyday life anyway, and because everybody knows that, we discount for it. So in an ordinary conversation, right, there are some things it's just not polite to talk about, right? But it doesn't mean we think, well, that person doesn't have those thoughts or do those things or whatever it is. We think, that's not what one talks about. And the same thing goes for Facebook and other contexts. There are just, we understand that that different contexts have different standards of acceptable behavior. And we take that into account. We allow for it when we form impressions.
Yeah. So I'd really love to open things up to some questions. Nadav's going to be coming around. I have one quick question while he's on his way. What recommendations do you give us as snoopers? How can we be effective snoopers?
Well, there's a lot of things you can do. But, the one thing that I really encourage people to do is to not be distracted by single objects. This goes back to what I'm saying, is if you think about personality, it's repeated behaviors. And so looking for themes in people's spaces, that's really important. Because there's many different, I often have people saying, something like, well, I have this kind of plastic, blue turtle on, top of my television. What does that mean? And the idea, and the answer is, I have no idea what it means. Because it could mean lots of different things. There could be many different stories for how you got to have that blue plastic turtle on the top of your TV. And with just one piece of evidence, it's very hard to disambiguate those different stories. You need to see these patterns over and over again. So maybe if there was a lot of turtles, that might think, okay, there's something with turtles going on, what could it be? And then maybe I'll see, oh, maybe it's something to do with their name, or they have an interest in this topic, or who knows, there could be many different reasons. Or it could be something completely different. There's a lot of kind of cool plastic toys around, or who knows what. And so you need to do those. So the three things I typically ask people to do, recommend people do, is they go in and they should look in for the, first they should ask, what are the objects somebody has? So if somebody, this person has a desk calendar, that's a desk organizer, that's something, that's a piece of information you should take in. But you have to go beyond that. You have to ask the state of that object. Because we can all, and in fact, I've done that. We can all go off to, Office Depot and on some, bright, deluded day about ourselves and think, if we buy a desk calendar, that will make us an organized person. But I see lots of calendars where they bought it and never filled it out, right? And so you have to look at how it's used, because that its state will tell you if it's actually used. And then the other key thing to ask about these objects is their location. The location will tell you the psychological function that it forms. A good example of that is something like photos people have. So the photos somebody has of on their desk in an office, which way are those photos facing? Are they facing towards the person, away from the guests? Then it's more about one of these things I called a social snack, a thought and feeling regulator. It's for them. If it's turned around and facing out, then it's more about an identity claim. It's a statement they want to make to others. So the location really helps you. The very same object can have different psychological functions depending on its location.
Beautiful. Where's our first question? Okay. Nadav? Okay, just back in the back.
Chris, you were talking about some potentiality in the design of people's home. I didn't quite get the underlying thought is that if people have some idea of how they might want to change their life and their situation, that changing their living space would be an essential step to doing that, or a part of their whole process. And is that realistic, that people actually do wind up going through changes and liking the new, different type of space?
I think that, yes, it's possible. What I've found is that it's hard enough just to be yourself, essentially, and to just represent who you are, really, because in my experience in architecture is there's a quite, particularly as you get up to people who can actually pay for architecture, there is actually quite a bit of a personality claim. It's an identity claim. There's a very high percentage of people that that's one of their primary goals, essentially, is to make some kind of claim of prominence or of identity or like that. So I would say that's common in sort of the upper income architecture, and it's not, it's not true about everyone, but really it's the same issue that we face in life. Was, are you going to be representing yourself as someone you're not because you don't want to be embarrassed, or you don't want to, you want to have a pretense because you're feeling insecure, or are you going to be who you are? And so what I think of, how I think a home can be used as a tool is basically a process that's available to you that's private, essentially. Because, see, Sam goes into, if you have a behavioral psychologist that you let into your house, then you are going to be exposed. But the truth is, most of us have public and private spaces. And part of what I do with my clients is I'll force them, like he does, to go into all of their rooms. And what you find is that it's very common for people to have a very nice-shaped public space, and then you can't even walk in their closet, you know? And they don't clean their toilet, you know? So I have clients that are immediately running around cleaning their whole house. I'll say, no, do that, because I won't know how I can adapt to the habits you already have. So I guess what I'm saying is that I think it's possible and, in fact, not even terrifically difficult to use your home essentially as a self-development tool. And it starts off essentially, and in fact, what I believe is it's actually possible to use it as a source of creating well-being. And I think there is evidence for this. There's another a field called evidence-based design that's used in, real scientists like Sam develop, which applies social service, social science findings from real research to hospital environments. And so there's actually quite a bit of research about creating well-being around that. It's just, it's distributive, it's not personal. So what I try to do is go to your house and figure out what has you be well. And that's what's really more different about what I do, because there really is research that says that, in fact, the Children's Hospital here and, the Dell Center was used quite a lot of evidence-based design to design that hospital. And they have proven research about health outcomes, people getting out of the hospital quicker, children, et cetera. Now, I was going to do that to you a minute ago, but I thought, how rude. No.
Is there another question? Right up here.
Okay, I'm talking into it. When you talked about Facebook, you had said, raising the hands that people, and I had voted in the second, because I was thinking in terms of people put on their page what they want to be. Then you talked about, I guess you'd call them lies of commission or false positives. But to some extent, what do you think about the false negatives, things people leave off their Facebook page? So, I mean, is there an aspirational aspect to what people put on and leave off? I mean, if I'm a convicted felon, do I brag about that? You know, or do I want to more emphasize the parts of my life that I would like to be or spend more time doing? Because it's voluntary and outward facing in a lot of senses. That changed people's use of that space.
Well, I think people do leave things out, but they do that in all social contexts. So my comparison standard here is not perfection. It's compared with any other social context. The convicted felon probably wouldn't, tell you that stuff in ordinary, everyday conversation as well. I mean, how we did the study is we went to great lengths to find out what the people were like. So what we did was we had people fill out extensive personality questionnaires, but we know that, people may be either trying to create a good impression or be deluded about themselves. So we also got data from a bunch of their friends, too, to tell us what they were like. And then we asked the person also, what would you like to be like? What's your ideal self? And then we compared people who had no idea what this person was like. They just looked at somebody's Facebook profile, and we saw whether those impressions, purely based on Facebook profiles, which of these things they correlated closely with. Now, it could have been they correlated closely with both, or they correlated with one for some traits and the other for other traits. It turned out, though, that it correlated much more strongly with how the person really saw themselves.
Chloe Nadav's got go ahead, Chloe.
That wasn't even a question.
Thank you, honey.
Did you pay her for that?
I have a question. Something we haven't gotten to is how our spaces and the things that we kind of decorate our lives with impact our relationships and can impact our relationships. Before the next question, could you maybe both comment on that briefly?
Well, I think Chris is doing some very interesting work on this, and so I look forward to hearing his response, because he has a great exercise that he does in his work, and I saw the results of some of that in some of the homes I looked at. But my grad student Lindsay Graham, she's doing a study right now with looking at new couples as they move into a space together and how they negotiate that, and that's very important. I mean, I don't know how many of you know the film When Harry Met Sally, but there's a classic scene about when the couple are moving in together and they're arguing about the wagon wheel coffee table and whether that wagon wheel coffee table should stay or go. And these sorts of things, when people are sharing space, they can be the center of some very tough issues that people must face about it, in terms of, well, how are we going to negotiate this? Is it going to be my place and you can have your little space over there? Is it going to be your space? Is it going to be some kind of unhappy compromise between the two? Is there going to be some kind of emergent space that it reflects the couple together? Now, Lindsay's collected the data, but we haven't done the analyses yet, but I think this is a key question, and I think it's the stage where many social dynamics play out. What I've noticed from going around people's spaces is that often if somebody takes a back seat in a joint space, they will have somewhere where they can go and retreat and be themselves, whether it's like a garden shed or a study or somewhere where they can just go and kind of reconnect with who they are.
So in my world, it's mostly World War III between couples, actually. And so that's why I have them sort them out into their own corner early. I've learned to ask questions about how their relationships are very early, because when you do what I do, you end up being a therapist whether you want to be or not, or are qualified to do it. So I ask them questions like, where in your house do you find your spouse particularly irritating? And that one lays it right out on the table. Or there's other exercises I use that are basically about me understanding the dynamics of the relationship. And that's not even, it is partly their house, but it's also about how I survive the relationship with the clients. So I'll ask them things like, name three ploys you use to get your way in your marriage. And it's amazing. People, in fact, most of them will just sit right out and tell you. You know, it's like, well, I withhold sex, or you know, I pout, or, you know. And so that helps me understand what's coming in my direction eventually. But, you know, everyone knows, it's kind of part of the whole mystique of home improvement that it's very, very difficult on relationships, and that's absolutely accurate. Living in or around a home in the middle of a remodeling project is probably one of the most trying experiences of your life. So everybody goes into this, oh, I'm going to have this wonderful new house, and then usually they're psychotic by the time they actually move in. So a lot of what I try to do is prepare them for that, and then mitigate all the conflicts and negotiate everything and try to reduce the emotional level down to kind of more like a business relationship. In other words, if you, you know, she wants a beautiful furniture-grade cabinet kitchen, and he thinks that's $20,000 too much. He wants a workshop. She hasn't seen him in a workshop in 15 years. She knows he's just, you know, he's really not going to do anything. He's going to spend the money, get the tools. It's going to gather dust. And what I say is, look, that doesn't matter. Just give him the workshop and trade it for the kitchen. Just do business, see? And that it seems to take all of the emotional content out of the situation. So it's really about negotiating around money. You know?
You've said, you know, to me many times that it's much easier to remodel your house than remodel your mate. And I think there are a lot of, what's really key is that there are a lot of architectural solutions to either diffuse some of these things that go wrong or to enhance the things that go right. It's just so kind of, you know, mind-bogglingly simple, yet not done. You know, as an example Chris gave me of, you know, a couple who, you know, oh, he never puts the toothpaste tube on. You know, how difficult can it be to put the cap on the toothpaste? I mean, why doesn't he knows I do it? Why doesn't he do that? Is undermining me? I mean, you know, and like the cap on the toothpaste tube becomes this kind of central, you know, focus for some, you know, story about disrespect or whatever. You know, Chris says, all right, we'll build them two sinks. You know, and it's just a few, just, you know, something that's remarkably simple but can have a big impact on those sorts of things.
Yeah. Is there another question? There's one right up front, and you've got one right there.
I'm wondering what sort of personality traits are most clearly or easily deduced from either people's objects in their living space or from the Facebook profiles, as you discussed earlier.
That's a great question, because different domains reveal different personality traits. So when I first started doing this research, I thought that the trait that would really show through very clearly would be what we call in the field conscientiousness, but it's really about dependability and people who are able to plan and think ahead and control their impulses. So you'd think that was the one that would show up most clearly in spaces, and indeed it does. Indeed, you can judge this from snooping around people's offices or their homes, and in the ways you'd expect it to. These people have organized spaces. The books are in the bookshelf. They have supplies before they run out. The places are generally neat and tidy. So those are the sorts of things you'd expect. It turned out that we also found that you can judge even more accurately than that a trait known as openness to experience, which is really how sort of people high on this trait tend to be more broad-minded. They're curious. They like thinking in the abstract. For them, the idea of uncertainty is interesting and intriguing. Versus people at the other end of the dimension, these are people who prefer the concrete. They're traditional. They're conventional. For them, uncertainty is disconcerting and worrying. Now, neither one of these is intrinsically better, but those sorts of things show up very well in people's spaces. And the real key to seeing openness is A, finding a space that's distinctive. So it's like a higher order thing. It isn't you see a specific thing there. You go into somebody's space and you think, wow, you know, I've never seen, a bed made out of a canoe before, but there you go. And so that person is suddenly high on openness. But the other key is really diversity. These people like different things. So they would have a high diversity of music, a high diversity of books, a high diversity of magazines. Even though somebody else might have many more books, but if they're all on one narrow topic, that wouldn't be such a good signal for something like openness. That these people also tend to have more inviting, you can also tell from inviting spaces that extroverts tend to have inviting spaces. If you think about extroverts, what extroverts like people, we know that. They just like to be around people. They even prefer music with voices in compared to introverts. They're drawn to people. And so if you go to their offices, for example, these look how are inviting spaces. Maybe they have some kind of candy on the desk to lure you in and a comfortable place to hang out. And the door is open. Whereas the introverts, they really don't want you there. The door's probably not closed in an uncomfortable chair, and you just kind of don't really want to hang out. But extroversion is something that also shows up very clearly on Facebook profiles. These guys, as you would expect, they have many more friends, they're members of many more groups, they say more, those sorts of things.
Oh, we have time for couple more questions. It's going crazy, Casey.
I have a question about orientation of new architecture now. Of course, it's very slick and contemporary and, you know, it's fabulous, but when you're talking about people making their personal statement and that sort of thing, then it doesn't appear, from what I've seen, to lend itself to a lot of personal effects. And so I'm just curious how you see making that personal psychological statement or making the home feel warm and friendly, blending with those spaces. I mean, I think we all love to see them architecturally and we'd love to live with that much order, but it doesn't seem necessarily reflect strongly people's personal lifestyle.
Well, we don't have enough time for me to answer that question, but I'd say that there's been, I think, ultimately, there's a philosophical split that has been mostly won by modernist architecture because basically the main theme in architecture in terms of the modernist movement is that architecture is art. And previous to that, there was a theme called form follows function. And where I come from in my work is that modernist architecture is extraordinarily beautiful if you want to live in a monument or you want to live in a painting, and some people do. But really, my experience is that mostly modernist spaces are not terrifically livable, and they're very cold emotionally. So I just have a different philosophy about it. I don't have a particular look that I do. I get the architectural styles I work in out of my clients' experience, and I feel like that's a kind of a higher calling for me. And that's a very minority opinion in my business, but that'd be how I'd answer it.
I think it's critically important that Chris doesn't have a look, right? Because what that tells you is his architecture isn't about him. If you have an architect who has their look, then you're adapting yourself to the architect, and that's exactly the opposite way it should be. And so I think that's a really, really critical thing. You also see this in design, you know, at the higher level, but also in ordinary design of offices, where people are not taking into account the psychological function of space. So when I go into people's offices, you know, and I see people have kind of like, if they're in a cubicle, they're kind of balancing things along the edges of the cubicle and sticking things to the edges of the walls and putting maybe an extra barrier around. It suddenly you realize, well, wait a minute. This is all based on kind of on carrying out the practical tasks in an office and completely neglects the psychology of being in one of these spaces, the fact that people want to display stuff, some of it for themselves, some of it for others. They want to be able to affect the levels of privacy they have and the signals they send. And I think that an architecture that can take into account the role of psychology in space will result in people who are happier, healthier, and more productive.
We have time for just one more question. I don't know where Nadav is. There he is.
Okay, so this is related to some of the things you've been talking about recently in terms of the functionality of space and ignoring sort of the humanness of it. There's also a class issue related to space. It's great, it's wonderful if you can afford a house, but there are whole swaths of people who simply can't, through no fault of their own. They can't afford a house, and so they end up living in apartments. And some of them are better than others, and at least for my end, most apartments that I can afford and that I have ever been able to afford and that most of my friends have ever been able to afford are just badly designed. They're too small, they're too dark, they're too narrow. They don't have, the cabinets are like an inch not deep enough. You know, so, and that effect, they don't have enough windows. They aren't well designed. So is there something out of the work that you do, that both of y'all do, that can hopefully make its way into architecture and spaces that are being built so that people who can't afford houses can actually have a place where they can feel like they can personalize and can become and thrive and grow instead of being in this little dark shell because there's one window and you open the refrigerator and it hides the window.
I think Chris can talk with greater expertise on the practice of this, but I think one of the things that can be done is in terms of analyzing, building places so that they can be flexible, because somebody else, you know, may be in the sort of place that you would, with big windows and big cupboards and everything, and they think, oh, I'm so self-exposed, you know, I'm exposed, I don't have any privacy, everybody can see in, it's too bright, I can never find things in the cupboards because they're too, you know, just an inch too large, or whatever it is. and I think this is the key thing, is that there are some basic trends you can have, but really it's building in such a way that people can adapt it to their own needs.
I think what I would say about that is that sometimes when I'm speaking to people, I'll pull out what used to be an iPhone, but now it's an Android. And I'd say, look at the work that went into this phone to make it fit you and who you are. It's actually astonishing to me that in a world where there are entire bodies of science and practice where how human factors are being considered in the design of almost every product that we have, ergonomics, all these different fields, the one place that I see it missing is in architecture. And I find that extraordinary. And I consider it sort of a moral crisis. And so that's what I'd say is that there is change going on. It's sort of in geological time, you know? And so I think that what it really comes down to is consumers are essentially going to have to demand more, because the truth is it's not really about hiring an architect. It's about are our buildings built to have people feel better and be well? That's a very basic thing. And if you think about it, that's our relationship with our most important environment. We're all preoccupied and all very concerned about this nature of our planet, what's going on here, and how we're having an impact on it. Well, look, if it's possible to create a living space that actually supports your well-being and you don't do it, then how do you think you're going to save the whales? I mean, if you won't take care of your own kids, you know? So I think that's what's going to require, essentially, is that people are going to have to see that there's a much more profound, you know, what we do in life is have experience. Experiences, buildings create experiences, environment create experiences. And until we demand that from the people that build our buildings and create our world, we're going to have a whole planet full of boxes.
Well, I think that's a good note to finish on. And thank you to Sam Gosling and Christopher Travis for coming out this evening. I really appreciate it. It was wonderful. And I would really love to invite everyone out for our next Views and Brews. Next Tuesday, we'll be talking about brands with Frank Sinatra. A discussion about who he is, his life, his work. We'll have a live band, and Rabbi Neil Blumhoff will join us to discuss his life. That will begin at 7 o'clock next Tuesday. Hope to see you all there. Thank you, everyone, for coming, and check the Views and Brews section of KUT.org for archives.
Thanks so much for tuning into this podcast, produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. For more information on KUT programs and to support the station, go to KUT.org. And thanks again.